Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. From Oxford University, we're going to talk about research confirming that chicory, the inulin in it, is good for blood sugar. That'll help a lot of diabetics in the audience. We're also going to look at how the American Chemical Society says that pure maple syrup can reduce chronic inflammation. And also, peanut protein has bioactive components that keep your arteries healthier. And high doses of vitamin C improve cancer treatment, and that passes a human safety trial, University of Iowa. We're also going to look how magnetic brain stimulation, I mentioned it last week for a different condition. Now I'll show you how it can give you healthier gut bacteria, University of Milan in Italy, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, from our public health segment, new research talks about how extreme heat threatens the rise of megacities, meaning that scientists are warning that even a modest rise in the average global temperature will put millions of city dwellers in the United States at greater risk of extreme heat. And I'll go more into that. Also today, we're going to look at a government study from 1991 that proves they knew the DAP vaccine causes microcephaly, and that is a serious situation. They knew all along, and they covered it up. We'll uncover it today. And, of course, we also like commentaries. I write commentaries. I present commentaries from others. Today, Chris Hedges, A Nation of Walking Dead, from Truthdig, and Countdown to Disaster, Trump's Looming Afghan Crisis, from David Rosen. Our audio clips today, we're going to take a look at several, including one from George Carlin about divide and conquering. And then a retired General Wesley Clark reveals an interesting conversation he had with a fellow officer at the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. It's not what he said that matters, but I'll explain why I want you to focus on it from a different perspective. Then here's a question that some of you have raised, and we will address in part today. Do you believe that many of the symptoms that are manifesting from Donald Trump are based upon him having any form of brain problem? Could he be suffering from dementia? Sounds far-fetched? Maybe not. We'll play you an audio clip, and then I'll give my own response to that. So that's what we have, and I will be opening our line today for some calls on our talkback segment, but I want you to wait a while before that, and I'll tell you what to call in on. Now we go to Oxford University, a journal article published in European Journal of Nutrition, and this new research shows that inulin, I-N-U-L-I-N, fiber from chicory root is beneficial for metabolic risks, including managing your blood sugar. And that was confirmed this week. So that's important. So when you want to maintain a normal blood sugar, just have yourself some of the powder, some chicory root powder. Quote, lowering the blood glucose at your blood sugar response to food products with chicory inulin or oligofructose instead of sugars could contribute to prevention and reduction of the risk of chronic metabolic disease, end quote. So in lay languages, when a lot of people eat a food, their blood sugar spikes up. That's not good. And then it falls down below normal. You end up with this high-low, high-low. You have energy, and then you have fatigue. And that also can be interpreted emotionally, which could mean some people get on a caffeine sugar binge, and they become a little hyper, and then they go into the doldrum when the blood sugar goes below a normal level, and then they end up feeling kind of blue. Well, think of how many people have been diagnosed with bipolar simply because their emotions are erratic, high and low. That's what we're looking at. And that shouldn't be the situation. So anyhow, that's that particular study. Now, a lot of people don't eat maple syrup because they're under this impression that it's just a sugar and it's not good for you. That's not necessarily true. In fact, from the American Chemical Society comes a discussion that shows that the natural sweetener in its pure natural organic form is actually good for you. And this was presented at the current issue of the American Chemical Society. And that's, by the way, that's the largest scientific society in the world at a symposium. And how it does it, quote from the study, "Scientists from around the world share the results of their research that expands the science of maple syrup's potential impact on several areas affected by chronic inflammation. These include metabolic syndrome," there's your diabetes, "brain health, and liver disease." Now, when your brain is inflamed, you end up with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, etc., and as well as your liver. So it also does all this by helping give you very healthy gut bacteria, what are called gut microbiome. So that's good. So you can have, and this was according to the University of Rhode Island, you can have some maple syrup into your diet and maybe in a smoothie over some steel-cut oatmeal or millet or quinoa in the morning, and you could help turn off inflammation in your body and have healthier gut bacteria. A lot of Americans don't eat peanuts, but peanuts are not a nut. They're a legume. According to the University of Pennsylvania, published in the Journal of Nutrition, peanuts can actually reduce your risk of heart disease, just a handful of peanuts. Now, ideally, you want organic peanuts. I mentioned last week the Brazilian red peanut is your best in the world. Or you can get peanut powder. But what it does, it can help stabilize your blood sugar. It can help open up your blood vessels. And it can help your heart work less with the amount of blood that it has to pass through 100,000 miles of blood vessels in your body, increasing the risk of heart disease and stroke if they become constricted. Well, the peanut helps to keep them relaxed and pliable. And in this study, participants ate peanut as part of a meal, and it made a big difference. So let's add, along with walnuts and macadamias and pine nuts and almonds, let's add peanuts to our regular meal schedule. I can remember back in around 1972, I received a call from a man who was doing research on vitamin C, and I'd written about high-dose vitamin C, and he said, "High dose is not high enough based upon what you're writing." And I said, "Well, do you have clinical experience?" And his name was Fred Klinner from North Carolina. And he said, "Yes, I've been using about 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C, treating a wide variety of patients very successfully. And that's the predominant thing I use, is high-level vitamin C." He was using it intravenously. And so, all right, I began to research it, and there was really no good science at the time. I did speak with the founder of vitamin C, the man who isolated vitamin C, ascorbic acid, who won the Nobel Prize, Albert St. George. And in turn, I met Dr. Erwin Stone, who was a major advocate of vitamin C in high doses. He, in turn, inspired Linus Pauling. Pauling kind of got into it a little later, but was a major voice for vitamin C in cancer. And it was Linus Pauling who said that based upon a study in Scotland that they had seen a substantial reduction in cancer, and these were on terminal patients. And so the Mayo Clinic, I believe it was the Mayo Clinic, replicated the study, but they did not actually replicate it. They allowed patients in there who had had chemotherapy. In the original study, there were no chemotherapy patients. And they didn't do as well, and therefore tried to claim that it wasn't equal to what Pauling had claimed and Dr. Ewan Cameron had claimed. In point of fact, Pauling wrote multiple rebuttals, came on my radio program to rebut them, and we asked him, do a study that Linus Pauling gives you the protocol for. They wouldn't do it. And it was kind of dead in the water then. Nobody wanted to use vitamin C. Unfortunate. Well, we did. We helped thousands upon thousands of patients at the Tri-State Healing Center, our medical team, and it was with high-dose vitamin C. But we went way beyond 50,000. We went up to 200,000 milligrams. We were reversing AIDS completely, helping other AIDS patients, overcoming pneumocystis, crenia, and infections and thrush, helping women with breast cancer, uterine cancer, helping people with chronic fatigue syndrome across the board. And then when I finally closed down the center, nothing went forward. Now, all these years later, I'm reading from the University of Iowa a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Cell, and here's what it says, quote, clinical trials found that it is safe to regularly infuse brain and lung cancer patients with a 800 to 1,000 times the daily recommended amount of vitamin C as a potential strategy to improve outcomes of standard cancer treatment. And, well, that's good, but not as high a dose. If they went higher, they would get better results, but they're very conservative, and they're going to play it close, very close. They're starting off with what amounts to 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C. That's not even half of what I would start at. So let's hope that this benefits people, and then they start to increase their dosage after that in new research. To stimulate your brain, you can create weight loss in the body by making gut bacteria healthier. That's unusual. Now, we're talking about low level of the magnetic stimulation using magnets, electrified magnets. You can barely feel it, but there's like a little pulse every second, a magnetic pulse into the brain. It's a non-invasive electromagnetic brain stimulation technique, and it helps people who are overweight to lose weight, partly by changing the composition of their intestinal bacteria, the so-called gut microbiota. And the results of the technique called deep transcranial magnet stimulation is presented at the Endocrine Society's annual meeting. So that's important, easy to get, inexpensive, and makes you healthier. And also, to wrap up our health and nutrition, I've talked a lot about telomere, T-E-L-O-M-E-R-E, and how the length of the telomere can determine the risk of different diseases and including cell senescence, or the lifespan of a cell. This is from the University of Pittsburgh, and it's a new study that talked about how the caps of the DNA that protect the tips of the chromosomes can predict cancer risk. And so that's another study to look at that shows, yeah, telomeres make a difference. The healthier lifespan, the longer the telomeres. You exercise, longer telomeres. Vegan, healthy diet, longer telomeres. Meditation, yoga, prayer, longer telomeres. If you live in a healthier environment with less toxins, longer telomeres. So taking the right nutrients like NAD, L-carnosine, coenzyme Q10, resveratrol, vitamin C, longer telomeres. Eating a diet that also is not just plant-based but has a lot of polyphenols like from cherries and blueberries, longer telomeres. So that way you can put, I'm going to guesstimate anywhere from 5 to 10 years onto your life. That's a big deal. Also, a new report links early life antibiotic use to inflammatory gut disease in adulthood. And this was published in the journal of Leukocyte Biology, and it suggests that antibiotic use in newborn offspring alters gut bacteria in ways that may increase the likelihood of inflammatory disease later on. And this was done at Monash University in Australia, published in the peer-reviewed journal. So, in lay language, it means this. All these vaccines we're giving these kids are causing the young children to end with infections because it's overstimulating a non-developed immune system. You give a kid what I consider absolute quackery, you give them a hepatitis B shot within hours of being born, you've just challenged their entire immune system, which is one of the reasons I believe that we have a high level of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, in the United States. Those kids that may be affected don't always end up with injuries that you can see that are obvious. Sometimes they end up with a overreactive immune system, so they're always coming down with colds. They end up with asthma. They end up with inner ear infections. They go to the pediatrician. They put tubes in their ears, and they give them antibiotics. And there's some children that stay on antibiotics for 1 or 2 months or longer. That absolutely wipes out, destroys all good bacteria, and lays the ground for bad bacteria. So that's one of the reasons that when we look at the ways that that infants end up over-vaccinated, end up with these infections, then as they grow older, they're very susceptible to different diseases. Just something to think about. And finally, a blueberry drink a day can help keep stress away. Now, I've already said that sweet onion a day can keep a stroke away, as well as cayenne pepper can keep a stroke away, and vitamin E can keep a stroke away, and an apple a day keeps everything away. But now we can add blueberries a day, at least a pint, can end up keeping depression away, anxiety away, and can actually improve cognitive performance, and that's important. The research was done in the Department of Food and Nutrition at Chung-Ang University in South Korea, and, quote, stress-induced cognitive impairment is related to the suppression of hippocampal neurogenesis that results from an increase in oxidative stress. It says psychological stress can induce dysfunctions in the nervous system, including cognitive impairment, anxiety, and insomnia. Recent studies have shown that both intense acute and chronic stress can have detrimental neurocognitive and neuroanatomical changes in the brain, mainly in the HPA axis. But then they were given a blueberry supplementation, and it made a big difference in how it related to stress. And so the takeaway message is to protect your cognition, to help reduce stress, blueberries. So that's important. And by the way, a lot of you don't get massage. You should, for a lot of reasons. If you get a good clinical, board-certified masseuse, they can work on your body. If you have pains in a certain place, if you have pulls, tears, rips, if you have soreness, they'll know how to work with it, and that'll help you. This is from Indiana University, and it says that the study they did shows that real-world massage is effective in treating lower back pain. Quote, in the first study of its kind, researchers found real-world massage therapy to be an effective treatment for lower back pain. That's good. And it also just puts you at ease, and this was published in the current issue of Pain Medicine. That's it on Health and Nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to thank all the people from all over the world who tuned in last evening for what was supposed to be a 1 hour and became a 3.5 hour discussion, plus a film, on how we can survive almost any disaster. We had some very positive and very enlightened questions raised, and I answered dozens of questions from people everywhere and gave them a whole lot of information. So those who listened you now can be comforted in that you have the tools to survive just about anything if you apply it, get started on it. For those of you who missed it, we are posting it so you can go up to GaryNull.com, and we should have it posted later today so you can also download and benefit from it. And I want to mention that a 1991 government document shows that the government knew that the TDAP vaccine causes microcephaly. This is from Vaxer. It says, a study from as far back as 1991 confirms the United States government did indeed know there was a previous connection between the vaccine and microcephaly. If the link between the pertussis vaccine and the condition existed all the way back then, why wasn't that the first place we looked when Zika mayhem went global? The mass media shouted from the building tops that Zika was causing microcephaly, yet we have studies showing relationship between microcephaly and the pertussis vaccine. The exact study entitled Adverse Effects of Pertussis and Rubella Vaccine, a report of the Committee to Review the Adverse Consequences of Pertussis and Rubella Vaccine, stated, among symptomatic cases, presumed causes are frequently grouped according to the timing of the suspected insult as occurring pre, peri, or postnatally. Prenatal factors are thought to account for 23% of cases. Then it goes in to talk about the Alamedes, chromosomal disorders, neurological disorders, and that's where they mention it right there in the study. So they knew it. They lied to us. They never gave us that information. We presented it to you today. So the government knew that there was something causing all this problem way back then and chose not to do anything about it. Not surprising. I'm concerned, as I'm sure many of you are concerned, about what happens to people who give up. You wake up one morning, you look at the world around you, and you say, I don't know where I fit in. I don't see that light at the end of the tunnel. I don't see some epiphany. I don't see some catharsis. I don't see that hoorah-rah happening in my life. All I see is drudgery. I see problems. I see obstacles and challenges and crisis creating all kinds of drama that I have to respond to emotionally. It is understandable when you have everything going against you and seemingly nothing going for you to look for something that takes you away from it. For a moment or not, people, depending upon their background, some people just, they'll go to their religions. They'll say, okay, you know, Jesus suffered. Maybe I should be suffering. Others go to food. If I'm going to be poor, might as well be poor and at least enjoy something, my food. Others, it's watching television. If my life is bad, look at all those clowns in these reality shows. I mean, the most vacuous and obnoxious, selfish, narcissistic, stupid individuals. Yeah, I got troubles. I'm not like those people. I'm still a decent human being. I may be poor, but I'm still a loving, decent human being. I still have empathy and compassion, and I would help someone. And if I found a wallet, I'd try to look for the owner to get it back because it's not my money. And I could only imagine, what if I lost someone? Wouldn't I want someone to give it back to me? So each person deals with stresses in their own way. But a lot of people turn to drugs. And one of the drugs they're turning to today are the opiates. Now, some people, legitimately, cancer patients and others, they use them. Now, are there natural, non-toxic ways of dealing with pain? Absolutely. We've shared on at least 100 programs what we can do. But then, how many Americans are actually using these opiates? Millions. Tens of millions. And that's not good. According to Chris Hedges, these opiates and the experiences that simulate the deadening effect of narcotics are mechanisms that keep us submissive and depoliticized. And desperate citizens, in Aldous Huxley, I talked about it several months ago on the program, his 1932 novel, Brave New World, ingested the pleasure drug Soma to check out of reality. Our own versions of Soma allow tens of millions of Americans to retreat daily into addictive mousetraps that generate a self-induced autism. What does this mean? It means that the United States consumes 80% of opiates used worldwide, and more than 33,000 died in this country just in 1 year from opiate overdoses. There are 300 million prescriptions written, $24 billion spent in 1 year in the United States for painkillers. Americans supplement this mostly legal addiction with over $100 billion a year in illicit marijuana and cocaine and methamphetamine and heroin. And nearly 14 million U.S. adults, or one in every 13, regularly abuse alcohol. But these monetary figures are far less than what we spend on gambling. Americans in one recent year lost $119 billion gambling, with another additional $70 billion, or $300 for every adult in the country, spent on lottery tickets. Federal and state governments rely on tax revenues from legal gambling and on lottery ticket sales will do anything to halt the expansion of the industry or the economic and psychological toll it exacts on those in financial distress. And state-run lottery games had sales of $73.9 billion in 1 year, according to the North American Association of State Provincial Lotteries. Now, this revenue is vital to the budgets beset by declining incomes and deindustrialization and austerity. State lotteries provided more revenue than state corporate income tax in 11 of the 43 states where they were illegal, including Delaware and Rhode Island, South Dakota. The poorest third of households buy half of all lottery tickets. Slot machines and other electronic gambling devices are engineered to draw us into an Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole. They, like our personal computers and handheld devices, cater to the longing to flee from the oppressed world of dead-end jobs and crippling debt and social stagnation and a dysfunctional political system. We become rats in Skinner's box, frantically pulling levers until we are addicted and finally entranced by our compulsion to achieve fleeting, intermittent, adrenaline-driven rewards. And much like what happens to people using slot machines, the pigeons and the rats in Skinner's experiments up at Harvard did not know when they would get a reward or how much they would get. They became the most heavily addicted to operating the levers or pedals. Indeed, Skinner used slot machines as a metaphor for his experiments. The engineers of America's gambling industries are as skillful at forming addictions as the country's top five opiate producers: Purdue Pharma, Johnson & Johnson, Insys Therapeutics, Mylan, and DuPont. There are 460 commercial casinos, 486 tribal casinos, 350 card rooms, 55 racetracks, and hundreds of thousands of gaming devices, many located in convenience stores, gas stations, bars, airports, even supermarkets. So the rush of anticipation available in 20-second bursts over hours and days and weeks and months creates an addictive psychological zone that the industry calls continuous gaming productivity. Heart rates and blood pressure rise. Time, space, and the value of money and human relationships hypnotically dissolve. The state of extreme social isolation occurs. And gambling addicts, like many addicts, are often driven to crime and bankruptcy and emotional imprisonment. Many lose everything: their marriages, their families, their jobs, their emotional health, sometimes their lives. Gambling addicts have the highest rate of suicide attempts among addicts of any kind. It's 1 in 5 or 20%, according to the National Council on Problem Gambling. Donald Trump is in large part a product of gambling culture. His career has not been about making products, but about selling intangible and fleeting experiences. He preys on the desperate by offering escapist fantasies. This world is about glitter, noise, hype. Trump called the Taj Mahal, his now-closed bankrupt casino, the 8th wonder of the world. The more money you spent, the greater your value. The more you were pampered, given free hotel rooms and gifts, handed passes to special clubs with lavish buffets, scantily clad hostesses hovered around you, serving complimentary drinks. If you spent big, you were invited to exclusive parties attended by supermodels and famous athletes, and decorated chips, some featuring a photo of Donald Trump, turn cash into a species of monopoly money. But in the end, when you were broke, when there was no more money in your bank account and your credit cards were maxed out, you were thrown back, even in greater financial distress, into the dreary universe you tried to obliterate. That's what it is. Gamblers are closely tracked by the casino industry. The length of time gamblers spend on machines increases the profits for the casino. The science of keeping people in front of slot machines, called time on device, within the industry has led to the creation of these ergonomic consoles, the appealing warm screens on slot machines, seductive video graphics, and surround sound acoustics. The industry also invests heavily in surveillance. Gamblers carry player loyalty cards. They insert these cards into the slot machine when they play. These cards linked to a central database are used by the industry to build profiles of gamblers. The value and frequency of bets are captured along with wins and losses. The industry knows when the players take breaks, where and what they eat in the casinos, what they drink, what hotel rooms they select. And slowly the traits and habits of the gambler, triangulated with demographic data, are pieced together to allow the industry, the gaming industry, to build a complete personal profile. And with the profile, the casino determines at what point a player will accumulate too many losses and too much pain and is about to walk away from the machine. A few moments before that pain level is reached, a hostess will magically appear with a free drink, a voucher for a meal, or a ticket to a show. Casinos can also use profiles to project how much a player will spend gambling during his or her lifetime. The industry was the human laboratory for refinements now incorporated into security and surveillance organs of the state. Many surveillance marketing innovations first were used in casinos. So that's what we become. We are becoming a part of their algorithm. And so just think of it. Trump understands this longing for escape and the art of creating an updated version of P.T. Barnum's Grand Traveling Museum, the Menagerie, the Carnival, the Hippodrome. Trump used his skills as a con artist to pull in hundreds of millions of dollars and then to achieve the presidency. Well, the corporate state will expand our access to a variety of opiates and numbing situations to temporarily alleviate our stress, our financial dislocations, our depression, our anxiety. Aided by state and local governments, it will build new pleasure palaces. It will lure millions into glittering and seductive Venice flytraps. It will make sure we have tempting retreats within each of our proximities for easy reach to achieve a death and life experience, and much of society will be put to sleep. Those who refuse to become zombies, who rise up to resist, who seek at all costs to remain distinct individuals, will be silenced with the corporate state's cruder tools for submission, and that is force. So here is the question to the audience in our talkback segment. Think each day of how many times you are manipulated, how many times you are seduced, how many times you're tempted, cajoled, maneuvered to eat something that your body should not have, drink something that is counterindicated and counterintuitive to anything representing health. You actually become sicker. Cancer, heart disease, diabetes, as just some of the indicators of what will happen. Think of the people who want you to put money in their bank and then charge you an interest rate. You pay them an interest rate to, in effect, hold your savings. You work for that savings. Now you're giving them your savings, and you're paying them to put your money in their bank. Think of the politicians, the time and again, whether Democrat or Republican, will go into poor areas, as they do, knowing that those poor areas have no hope, so you promise them hope. And then one after the other, you're there, you kiss the babies, you eat the hot dog, you shake some hands, and you're whisked away. Those people are left with the idea that maybe, just maybe, it'll be Bill Clinton who will bring them out of poverty. Or maybe then George Bush would. And then maybe Barack Obama would. Well, they don't want Hillary because she was a part of promising them the last time around, and she didn't deliver. Her husband didn't deliver. So maybe this guy Trump will deliver. And they couldn't understand Bernie. He was just a little too confusing to a lot of people. And they wanted nothing to do with others. They didn't want Ralph Nader. They didn't want Rocky Anderson. They didn't want Jill Stein. They didn't understand them. They should have had those, but they didn't. And people are not going to vote for what they don't understand. They have a very narrow view of life and reality. And they want everything in black and whites, no grays. So they won't forget when you made a promise and not delivered. So that's why they go to the gambling, using what little money they have to see if they can't make enough to get back what they've lost in the rest of their life. Or if that doesn't work and they've lost everything, then they take the opiates, because frequently they get those on prescription and it's paid for by the government. In any way, America has manufactured an entire addictive class. The helpless, not the hopeful, those who have been burned out, abused, and have no future. There's still a lot of money to be made every year on that group of people. Why should we believe any politician or any agency that exploits us? The lottery is an exploitation. Gaming is an exploitation, but so is our entire political system. How would you counter that? What would you do to change it if you were in charge, if you had power? What dictates would you bring forth that could stop us from being a nation of addicts? Wesley Clark, listen to what he has to say.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is...
We're having a little technical glitch there. But he said enough. He said what was important. So let's just understand this. First of all, here is a man who was a former commander of NATO. And he was responsible during his stint at NATO for being a part of what was done in other parts of the world that were today, I believe, would be representing and should be looked at as war crimes. But he has a kind of a nice personality, and he seems to be open to the idea that we shouldn't have been in this conflict in Iraq. But he's telling us that they already believed that we were going to go to Iraq without any evidence. They needed this battle, but they had all the other seven countries. Well, all of those seven countries have been, except for Iran, have been invaded, and we've engaged in regime change. That should be enough for a major effort to be made in the alternative media to hammer away at what did they know and when did they know it. Well, they knew right then and there, before 2003, that they were going to invade. Well, then who was behind that? Well, we have the architects of it. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz. So we know the individuals who are part of it. So now we know who the master of this architectural plan was. And they also acknowledged that they knew that al-Qaeda was not in Iraq. They knew that these people were not responsible, but they had an agenda. So they lied to the American public, saying that it was about weapons of mass destruction. Then later they would lie, and the journalists would publish their lies as if, okay, there was just a breakdown in the quality of information coming from the intelligence community, the CIA, to these people. So they were well-intentioned people wanting to protect Americans from future terrorist attacks. And so it wasn't exactly accurate that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But don't fault them because their intent was to help us. No, this is showing way back then, 2 years before there was an invasion of Iraq, that we knew then that we were going to go in and invade Iraq and these other countries, including Syria and a regime change, and also in Iran. So we've had a whole condemnation of Iran. This is all part of it. So now we know that there's enough there to get them all charged. And by the way, there is no statute of limitations on war crimes. So these are all war crimes. So we should be bringing these people to justice. Now, we have a lot of lawyers in this audience. Why don't some of the lawyers in this audience come forward and work together pro bono to create a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, on behalf of the victims of the Iraq war, and use Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Commander of NATO and a four-star general, as a witness. Because he's said this many times. He's never walked it back. So that means that there'd be a lot of evidence. You bring him in a deposition, we'd find out who that general was that he spoke with, bring that general in. And now we got a case that this was premeditated with malice aforethought. There was no innocence involved here. There was no, well, they made the wrong choice, but for the right reasons. No, they made the wrong choice for the wrong reasons. They should be held accountable. Let's say hello to Lincoln from Mount Vernon, New York. Hi, Lincoln.
Hey, Gary, what's up? Hello?
Everything's good. What's your ideas today, Lincoln?
Yeah. In reference to what would I do to help to prevent things like gambling, etc., I think I would set up a government that would function like a government which should function, which is as the servant of the people, meaning that a system would be so established to remove all the desperation of the people. It would be a government in which everybody would be guaranteed a minimum income. It would be a government where people would be guaranteed school, education, housing, even a stipend to allow them to have certain amount of clothing, etc. And I think if you remove desperation from the people, you would remove people, you would lessen gambling, you would lessen crime, and the society would become a much, much more healthy place. And then after that, you know, do other things to encourage people to think analytically, make them become educated voters, educated participants in the system. That is it in a gist.
Who would pay for that gift to the public? You're talking about
trillions of
dollars.
I will show you that's an erroneous question, actually, because in terms of who would pay for it, first of all, money is just an idea, and it's a European concept, and money is not really real. So, and there's no such thing as a government going broke. Like, tax is actually foolish, and the economics that they teach us is bogus, because that's the reason why we are moving to a system where they're going to do away with physical money, and that's how they control the world. For example, people keep talking about money control the world. Money does not control the world. What controls the world is military might. When England dominated the seas and when before Europeans came to Africa and the Americas, nobody suffered from a financial deficit because we are ruled by definitions. Economics is nothing but a bunch of definitions. I was born in Jamaica. In Jamaica, before Europeans knew about the benefits of brown sugar was the cheapest sugar. Suddenly, as Europeans knew about the benefits of brown sugar, suddenly it became expensive, even though brown sugar is the easiest to come by, which means that it's less expensive to produce. The whole thing about money to pay for this and pay for that, it's all bogus. And
Lincoln, exhale for a moment. Take a deep breath. Relax.
No, I'm cool.
Okay, if you're cool, then let's break down what you said into its pieces and see if we can make this work, all right? That's the object of the exercise. I support the idea that we should be able to be a society that has enough wealth that if we distributed that wealth through different programs, that we should not have another hungry person or homeless person or a sick person. If you have universal health care, which is now $3.5 trillion, it's only based upon money. You take the profit out of our healthcare system, then you'd be able to get currently a $4,000 per treatment chemotherapy. You'd be able to get that for under $300. If you took out the idea of treating people for disease they don't have, then you're saving $200 billion. Diagnosing people, over-treating people for defensive medicine. Take away the ability to sue a doctor, and you no longer are burdening the doctor with $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year in malpractice. You have universal, no-fault medical insurance. So everyone is covered. If there's an accident, someone is covered. They're helped. And if they've lost wages, that wage will be reimbursed from a general fund. I'm only using a few examples now, but let's just say that then how do you pay for what you have? Well, it's simple. If you charge every single American a 1% tax, 1%, you're able then to pay. If you have every corporation, every individual paying 1%, then you have universal health care because you, A, take the profit out, B, you have a preventive program, C, you don't you get doctors into college, nurses into college, free dentists into college, but in turn, they cannot go out there and be making $1 million a year. They are given a nice living wage. They have no debt, and they're serving the public interest. They're part of the idea that let us use our skills, our desires, and our emotional philanthropy to help those who are sick. Then anybody, for any condition, go into any quality place and get treated and never sign a bill because there is no bill. They walk out the door. There's no administration of 33 to 35% of every dollar taken for administration, which is just profit to insurance companies. So what you do is you take an existing system that you would be opposed to, a capitalist system, but you make it a responsible system. So let's just, for our argument's sake, say that we have a responsible system of fair exchange. That way people are giving enough money to make a living, and then you go into a ghetto. Take the worst ghetto in America, and you say, all right, We have a 3-mile square area here that's just an island of poverty. You have gangs, you have drug addiction, you have alcoholism, you have a lot of abuse, you have decent people living in a harrowing situation. How do you change that? On the one hand, if you say money's not important and money's not real and the click of a computer and you can create millions if you're a bank and have the right to manipulate currencies, that's a separate issue. That is a political issue in our current system, which is a corporatized system based upon capitalism. We must first educate people to why money is an illusion and power is what, not the military, power is what controls all objects. Power is what then militarizes a country to invade another country. Militaries won't operate on their own. They have to have someone who, more often than not, is a sociopath mentally that will go in and destroy another country. So if instead you say, we're going to take this area, and you go into the area and you ask, who has skills? Who has skills as carpenters, masons, electricians, builders, town people? And who has skills as social workers, behavioralists, nurses, midwives? Who has skills working with children? And who has skills in helping people to get over addictive behavior? And all these people come together, and you're going to have all the skills within that community you need. They weren't working in that community, and they weren't valued in that community. There was great disharmony in the community. People were living out of fear for just being in the community itself because it was so easy to become a victim. Now you go to corporate America and you say, look, we're going to give you $2 tax deduction, which you can't get now, for every dollar you give to the foundation that goes into that community. It's in the community, and people who work there will be paid a living wage. So the people from the community are going to now get income that's going to allow them to get out of debt, A, and B, to be able to rebuild their community. So they'll have the schools they want. They'll have the therapy centers they want. They'll have the assisted living. They'll have the community gardens. They'll have the natural way of evolving green spaces. And the city gives them the buildings, comes in, tears down everything it's not habitable. So they have open space, digs out the soil for 3 feet down, replaces it with topsoil that's not polluted with lead and cadmium. And now you have a community working within itself, for itself, and being paid to do so. And corporate America, that would never, no executive corporate America is ever going to step foot in any of these environments. They would exploit it if they could, but they can't. Their exploitation is, hey, there's no tax system out there that if we give you $1, you're giving us $2 in deductions in return. So now corporate America and its capitalism is how they use it is now creating the very environment from which people's quality of life can come back together, and political movements and social movements and humanistic movements can evolve within that community that can then go in and change the laws. Because right now, none of these ghettos anywhere in the United States has any political power, any political control. It's not involved in any of the political processes that allow something to evolve. You just don't wake up one day and say, today I'm a Marxist, today I'm an anarchist, today I'm a socialist, today I'm this. So that's how I'm going to see the world. You have to look at the world and say, this is the world I'm living in, like it or not. Now, how can I help change that so the injustices that I see are not overwhelming and overriding and I can make a difference? Well, you can't change it nationally before you change it locally, because all politics ultimately are local. So you can make a difference locally, and that's one way to do it, using the system's own constructs to your advantage. And we both come up the same place, just different methods of getting there, Lincoln. I'm Gary Knoll, out on the road doing another documentary that you'll see this summer. Have a nice day, everyone.